Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Jack Watts for Jack Watts Live, broadcasting to you today, not from the 10th floor of the We Believe Tower in Midtown Atlanta, overlooking the majestic Buckhead skyline, but from a room adjacent to the Gaylord Auditorium, where is at Opryland, where the National Religious Broadcast Convention is going on. And we are just having a great time up here. Now, folks, this is a really interesting time in American history. I saw something on the TV the other day where the National Security Advisor, Susan Rice, was being interviewed, and she was asked the question, now after all of the stuff that's come out about Benghazi, how do you feel about that? Do you feel like that there's been any kind of problem with anything? And she said, no, she didn't really regret a thing. She had given the best information that they had, which, of course, is a bald-faced lie. They scrubbed the CIA report, invented a spontaneous uprising by Muslims because of a YouTube video that had nothing to do with anything. She went all over national TV. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton went out in the Rose Garden, said the same thing, and then 2 weeks later, Obama got in front of the entire world at the United Nations and said the same thing, and it was all just a lie, not a mistruth, not the best information, a lie that has been used to cover up some other things. I don't get it. But more than anything, I don't get how the American people can allow things like this to stand. It just doesn't make sense. Now, we've got Mitchell Swain on the line, and he's running for the Republican nomination for the 10th District in Georgia for Congress, and it's an open seat. And I believe one that will be held by the Republicans. So if we can get Mitch in, and he is who I am supporting, I promise you, we will have somebody who will absolutely, positively hold the values of the Founding Fathers. At any rate, now, Mitch, you're on the line, I think. Is that correct?
I am, Jack. Sorry about that. I was up by Hard Labor Creek Park, and there's no cell phone out there. So I'm here.
I remember going over Interstate 20, and every time I go over Hard Labor Creek, I wonder what in the world that's all about, and who in the world ever named that? Do you have any idea?
I have none. No, but it's a pretty area, though.
Well, there you go. All right. Now, Mitch, this subject is something that has bothered me since day one. I find it interesting also that the ambassador who was murdered and his associate, both of whom were progressives and not, your basic conservatives, and yet it's the conservatives that are so upset about them being murdered, and the progressives say, well, we don't need to go into that. That was a long time ago. What difference at this point does it make? Well, it makes a bunch of difference, Mitch, and I'm wondering if this is something that has bothered you as it does me and some of the rest of us.
Well, there's a lot of concerns over there, Jack. Now, obviously, as you understand, I'm still affiliated with the Marine Corps. I am a colonel in the U.S. Marines Reserves, And I've written some policy for that region for U.S. Central Command. And, you know, so I can't speak to these people about what's occurred and criticize, because I still work for the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, and certainly the Commander-in-Chief. But for that whole region, though, I think one of the things we can say, broad brush, is that our foreign policy, as it is today, isn't advancing the way it should. And I think everyone would agree, too, that there's more violence today in that region than there was prior to 9/11. When we look at Tunisia, where the Arab Spring began with a fruit peddler emulating himself on fire out of frustration and the revolts that broke out, it started from Tunisia to Libya to Egypt. Certainly south of that, we have Ethiopia and Somalia, both lawless, no governments there to speak of. We go across the Red Sea. We look at Yemen. Yemen is the poorest country in the region, 35% unemployment. They have depleted all their oil reserves. They were an oil-producing country, and they're about to become the first nation to completely run out of fresh water. They have two civil wars going on there in that small country. We go up, we see the challenges facing Syria, the unrest in Lebanon, especially on the southern border of Lebanon, where it abuts to Israel. We go over to Iraq, and we see Al-Qaeda taking over.
I mean, there's a bunch of things that are troubling. And Dick, I understand that you're on the line too. Are you there?
Yeah, one of us was working today, so I just got home.
All right, okay, we'll go with that. Here's something that I wanted to ask, that when we're talking about the Middle East in particular, I think this is where we have shown some weakness. And for the first time, this was just reported today, a Gallup poll says for the first time, a majority of Americans think Barack Obama is not respected among world leaders. There's been a dramatic plunge in that belief. 53% now say that Obama isn't respected on the international stage. A year ago, 43% said that was true. So it's jumped 10%. And that is, along with the favorability rating of negative 51 to positive 41, this is a huge dip. And it's a little scary to me, you know, what is happening. And you know, understanding that, that Mitch works for, is in the Marine Corps as in the reserves, and he cannot go against the chain of command, which is absolutely an inviolate thing in America, and we get that. At the same time, if we're not respected abroad, and if Americans know we're not respected abroad, does this not give succor to our enemies, and does it not provide greater instability in the Middle East, in the Far East, in South America, and just about every place else?
What
do you think, Mitch?
I think the word you're looking for is what we have lost, I think we can speak to, is called moral authority. And what moral authority is for any great nation, it defines for your enemies what you believe you will fight for and defend, and it also reassures your allies, friends, and partners when you have their back for certain issues. And I think we have lost that. I think we've reached a point where we have not clearly defined in our foreign policy. And I won't pin this all on the Commander-in-Chief. You know, this is a team sport when you're dealing with foreign policy. But we haven't made it clear what it is the United States is willing to fight for. There was, not too many decades ago, we talked about freedom, liberty, and Western culture and values. And today, yet we speak about economic prosperity, regional security cooperation, security cooperation. And so when we look at those nebulous terms, it confuses our enemies, our adversaries, and our partners. And when you don't have good policy, it certainly emboldens other people like North Korea. And it confuses people, like Iran, who's trying to develop nuclear weapons similar to North Korea. There's two elements to to foreign policy, isn't there? There's the policy itself, the things that you define that you believe in. And then there's also the implementation piece of foreign policy. And the way I explain it to people is I think all of us, like our children, you know, to clean their rooms. And we might say, you keep your room clean, and if you don't keep it clean, I'll give you a spanking. Well, if your children don't clean their room, which is a good policy, but you don't follow it up with the discipline you promised, then you have a poor policy that's not being enforced and poor follow-through. On the other side, you don't want to just be spanking your children or disciplining your children. They say, why are you doing this to me? And you say, well, you weren't cleaning your room. And the child says, you never told me you wanted me to do that. And so I think there's some of that going on around the world where we say one thing, but then we don't follow through with our actions, or sometimes our actions lead us, and it confuses people on why we actually did an event that hadn't been pre-announced. So those are some of the challenges we have as a country. And as I mentioned, when you look at Europe and the Middle East, there's certainly a cobweb of problems over there, and they're all related. We certainly have al-Qaeda everywhere. We have a Sunni-Shia struggle for power, like we see in Syria and Iran and Iraq.
Well, you know,
they all affect each other.
We're arming al-Qaeda in Syria with assault weapons and more so that they can fight for themselves. We're providing these, and yet at home, the Second Amendment is assailed all the time, and specifically about people owning assault weapons. Now, it seems like, how are we arming our enemies with things that we say are wrong for our private citizens to have? And al-Qaeda is certainly not a formal nation or even a political group. It's just, it's a group of rebels. What's the difference?
Well, certainly. And then, of course, it confuses people when you're arming some rebels, say, as we did with Libya, and we are doing with Syria. But then, of course, you've got people that you claim are your partners, and there's a difference between allies, friends, and partners, right? You can work with someone but not like them. I think we've all had that experience. But, you know, you have Pakistan openly arming and supporting the Taliban and perhaps al-Qaeda. And so how can you do one action yourself and then tell someone else they cannot do, you know, the same similar action? I think broad brush we can say
that's
that.
That's kind of like telling one of your children they have to keep the room clean and not the other.
Sure. And so, you know, I think the Americans, the question we should always ask and that Congress should always ask before we send troops anywhere is, you know, why? What is our national interest there? And if you can have a compelling story or a compelling argument, then you certainly go. But, you know, too many events now are looking similar to others, and you can't always go. For instance, you know, there was unrest that people don't talk about in Bahrain. You know, there was elements of the Arab Spring that took place there. Now, we didn't report a lot of it in the news, and we certainly didn't send our troops there. Saudi Arabia did some action there. But we don't talk about the treatment of those protesters, do we? And many of the people that we could say Assad is killing in Syria are the same types of individuals that we are killing in Yemen. But because they're in Yemen, we say that they're terrorists, and therefore it's okay to kill them. You could almost say that Assad doesn't really have a terrorist problem so much as he has a geography problem. And so
When the drones killed El-Laki and his 16-year-old son, both of whom were U.S. citizens. Now, I got no love for El-Laki, but they were United States citizens, and they were killed by drones without due process. There's something about that, you know, even though, I mean, and trust me, I do not like El-Laki. Who would? But there's something about that that just rings like it violates our inalienable rights, which is something as Americans we have to just absolutely hold dear. In the same way that
That's a valid argument, but I could also make the argument that if I see a violent crime going down in Atlanta and the SWAT team circles the building and someone makes a sudden move with a firearm or is holding a hostage, that that SWAT member is within his rights to drop him without due process.
I don't believe the 16-year-old. I don't believe the 16-year-old had anything to do with any of this stuff. Maybe it was just collateral damage, and it's certainly no love loss. You know, he's with Allah with his 72 virgins, so good for him.
Sure. Well, and those are the moral problems that we have. And so again, you know, our foreign policy really has to be based on our moral foundations as a nation and defining
right,
what
Mitch,
it is.
I want to answer just one other thing about this moral foundation. And this is something that is very significant to me and to all of the people that would listen to my show, and that would be Israel. When asked if they believe that President Obama had their back, less than 10% said that he did. Less than 10% believe that the United States of America is committed to Israel, who has been our chief ally in the Middle East since 1948, after they were resettled and we were the first nation to recognize their identity. Now, that seems to me as if when we're talking about our national interests, as if it not only violates it, but it feels to me like almost like we're saying, well, you know, we really don't like the state of Oregon. We just want to, you know, we like all other Americans, but not Oregonians or something similar, because Israel has been our chief ally in the Middle East for as long as nearly everybody in America has been alive.
Well, and it's not only that close relationship that we've had for decades, but if we look at Israel, they're the only country over there that most emulates our beliefs, right? They're free. They have a democracy, free elections. People have liberties. They can do the things that they want to do. It's not a socialist nation. It is the only nation that has Arab population that can freely elect and vote for people. You know, people often forget that the Muslims within Israel are permitted to vote as citizens. And so we have that. I think one of the things, I'd like to always ask that person that polled those questions, because I don't think it's just that Israel or perhaps some Americans don't feel we have their back, but I think we've reached a point in our nation where even American citizens think, the government doesn't have our own backs, our own government. And we see that with what's happening with the IRS, targeting conservative groups. And I've always told people, you know, when we talk about our foreign policy, what we're really doing is projecting overseas our ideals and our values. And we're hoping that they'll catch and spread, right? But you can't export those ideals if you're not practicing them first at home. And I think as we look at the NSA and its desire and appetite for information on all of us as citizens, that's very spooky. And so how can we say that we still stand for freedom and liberty when we have these events occurring domestically, whether you want to talk about domestic surveillance, Fast and Furious, insider trading, you know, in Wall Street, you know, Gibson Guitar being, you know, having their doors kicked in. All of that's very, very muddling. We have a Department of Justice. We already know we have sanctuary states and cities not enforcing illegal immigration. So we've, you know, in some places we've just turned a blind eye to laws. And, you know, many people want us to be a nation of laws. And that's what I try to do with my plan as I run for office. We have to get back to the ideas that built our nation.
If you are elected, what can we count on you to do about this mess?
Well, I think the first thing that, you know, and people ask me, that's a very fair question, Jack. You know, obviously right now I am solely focused on fixing our sinking ship and not being concerned about the status of other ships in the same sea, you know, that being our foreign policy.
you know, we have to render aid to ourselves first and get back up on our legs, because our most violent days in this war are not behind us. Our worst financial collapse has not hit. But we must first isolate and strengthen ourselves, insulate ourselves from those events so that we can weather that storm. And so I look at, you know, we resolve immigration. We do a tax reform of the flat tax. We fix Social Security. We downsize our federal government, and we restructure the way our federal employees are hired and outside of unions. And by doing that, we become stronger as a nation. When I share my plan with many people, they say, well, Mitch, it's a beautiful plan, but how will you do it? Well, I try to remind people, these aren't five isolated bills. It is a plan that will work to fix the entire nation, not unlike a war plan I would develop to assault the beach. And if you looked at me and I said, here's my plan for Normandy, and people say, well, how will you do this? Well, I don't intend to hit the beach by myself. You know, I'm trying to find, you know, often people running for office, they're looking for voters. I'm looking for volunteers. I'm looking for an army of Americans that want to take back our nation. And we have to do it with force. Now, I don't mean force, physical force, but I mean force of will, force of resolve, force of actions, force of word.
Now, when President Obama said just the other day that he was through with his austerity measures and he was going full bore ahead, with our national debt at $17.3 trillion and him increasing our national indebtedness over 60% in 5 years, I wonder, what in the world are we talking about austerity? That's kind of like somebody on the brink of bankruptcy saying, you know what? What we really need is a new Rolls Royce and a bigger house.
Sure. And some believe, and I won't make the argument for them because, again, I still work for these people, global warming is our biggest threat as a nation. I would say that our biggest threat as a nation around the globe is our being delinked as the world's monetary reserve. The day that the U.S. dollar is no longer the world reserve, and we can no longer print money. And there's a great chance that China's positioning itself to do just that. They've signed 18 swap agreements. They're heavily involved in trade with Africa, heavily involved in trade in the Middle East. They're obviously in the South America. And they have $3.3 trillion of cash reserves, not $17 trillion of debt. So that's our biggest threat. If that ever delinked, if the U.S. woke up one day and we were delinked as the world currency reserve, we absolutely become Yemen overnight. And that would collapse us. And so those are the threats when I look at starting to print and spend money again. And also, often people think the $17 trillion that our government owes, that's the public debt, is the most sovereign debt, that we must pay that. And so they tax us. But they don't recognize that we as citizens owe $38 trillion of debt to each other. The cars we buy, the homes we buy, the credit cards we ran up. That sovereign debt, I would make the argument, is more important that I honor my bills to you, Dick, or my bills to you, Jack, you know, because I bought something from you. And if we're living paycheck to paycheck and we get to a point where it is more important for us to pay the government first before ourselves, our families, and our friends and contracts, we will collapse. And so I don't think that there's such a thing as austerity here. Any money the government doesn't take from me permits me to spend at my own discretion. And there's a finite number of bills floating around in this country. There's $1.3 trillion as of last January. So that's my two cents on that piece.
All right, Dick, you know, I've kind of dominated the questions here. What is it that you want to ask, Mitch?
Well, it's this whole thing with the Olympics that just ended and the way it seems to me that Putin is trying to reestablish, for I guess a lack of a better term, the USSR again. And I had a friend say to me that the term that they're using now is that Obama is Putin's bitch, and he just seems to be walking all this country I mean, is there, at this point, is there anything that we need to do? And I mean, I can't believe that it has anything to do with our government, but is what is it that we're going to be able to do to try and stop the way the world feels about us now? I mean, I really do believe that, like, as we were talking about earlier, that they people just don't believe that, that Obama has a backbone.
Well, again, I'm only going to speak to Putin and Russia, okay? So let's just understand that every single day that Putin gets out of bed, he wants to be remembered as a great man, and he wants Russia to be great again as well. And that's his goal. And if he has expansionist ideas, it's because Russia has a tremendous amount of resources, but very little labor force. And so, like, he does look to the Central Asia states as potentially areas where he could, you know, take them into satellite nations again. It's quite possible he looked at them as a labor force. Now, that's all speculation on my part. But I would say in that region, and you say, how do we position ourselves in a position of strength again? When we look at the European Union, NATO, our best ally, and make no mistake, they're our go-to partners, you know, if things in the world melt down. Of those nations, NATO now is more broke, the European Union is more broke than the United States. So my best ally is in a worse financial position than I am. We have 17 plus trillion of debt. They have 17 plus trillion of debt, but they have a few hundred billion more than us. And so we're at a point now where I have Greece can't even afford to put oil in its Navy vessels and go to sea. So how do we, as Western civilization, strengthen ourselves? And it's by getting our industry and manufacturing back, getting jobs back online, addressing our sovereign debt issues, paying that stuff down, living within a budget, and then, again, establishing moral authority around the world. This is who we are. You know, all nations have the right to self-determination. And so I always look at that when we say we're going to, you know, invade some nation or fight some nation. Well, they have the right to self-determine as a people how they want to live. As do we, and we always forget that. We have the right as Americans for self-determination. And if we choose to live by Judeo-Christian values, then that is the way that our land will run. And right now we seem to be losing the grip on what defines us as a nation and how we want to live going forward. I think
That's exactly right. We have freedom. The word, the definition of the word freedom has changed completely. When our ancestors came, they wanted the freedom to worship. They wanted the freedom to take the chance to make it on their own. And now what freedom is freedom from restraint, from doing whatever kinky little thing seems right in people's own eyes. And that is the changing from, you know, American exceptionalism into depravity and degradation. And we cannot continue on. And that, of course, is why, you know, is why I'm supporting Mitch for the 10th in Georgia. Now, Mitch, tell them what your website is and how they can get in touch with you, because we got 1 minute left.
Well, certainly, yeah. Thank you, Jack. My website is swan, one N, just like the bird, swanforamerica.com, and it's one word. And if you go to my site, you'll see I've written an essay about, you know, military strength and moral authority and our need to recapture our moral authority as a nation and our moral foundations as a nation. And then you can also look into the STAR plan and see how we can rebuild our financial house. Because that's what we need to do in order to rebuild this nation and live as free people again. As long as our government's in debt and they keep looking to us to bail them out, we are not going to be a free people. And I think that we've seen that with the IRS. Right or wrong, whether it was intentional or unintentional, that narrative has been established. The perception has been established. And we need to get back to not fearing our government anymore.
There you go. That's it, folks. And listen, Mitch, thank you so much. Dick, thank you. And, you know, we're really grateful to your friend who, you know, came up with this idea, you know, for a better term, you know, about what our president is in in relation to Barack Obama. We'll leave that one. I asked the question, so what can I say? At any rate, good night, y'all, and thank you, and God bless you, and God bless the United States of America. Good night.